conservative. It is a commitment that now bonds parents together, no matter what their political or religious affiliations are, and could provide a powerful constituency for holding our society more accountable to the needs of families and the well-being of children. Parents across the political spectrum are concerned and want help in shielding their children from the more toxic influences of modern culture. After all, studies by groups such as the Kaiser Family Foundation find that the majority of television programming contains some sexual content, but little discussion of sexual responsibility. Likewise, Democrats should not shy away from talking about the importance of parenting, regardless of people's familial arrangements, and its influence on early childhood development, behavior in school, economic well-being, and children's health. And Democrats, regardless of their own faith or lack of it, should express respect for the religious choices of others and for the role faith-based organizations can play in families and communities. After all religious communities, not just religiously conservative groups, have a stake in the quality of our communities. In a critical article entitled Adding Values, Anna Greenberg and her father, Stanley Greenberg, claim that more progressives have begun to understand that the future progressive agenda must focus not just on people's work lives, but on their family lives. They conclude, progressives also need to rediscover the family. For some three decades, the left neglected to affirm the centrality of the family, especially of two-parent households. The left must give itself permission to recognize the benefit of two-parent families to children. Democrats need to affirm the value of such family structure, even as they redouble their efforts on behalf of single-parent families whose battles are tougher. The battle for good parenting must not be a politicized one. It is too critical for the future of our children and too important for any definition of a good society. Indeed, the need to support parents in their deepest desires to be responsible parents could be one of the few areas left where we could and should find a broad political consensus and a crucial common ground. Conservative and progressive parents alike have many of the same worries and concerns, and could unite across their political dividing lines to combat the polluting and undermining cultural influences that put good kids and good values at risk. Indeed, when it comes to parenting, most of us are conservative, and most of us would support a progressive pro-family agenda if one were to be laid out. This is one issue, the passion to protect our kids and other people's children, that could really bring us together. Family and family values. Seldom has the importance of an issue been so great, and seldom has the political manipulation of it been even greater. The bonds of family that tie together our most important and intimate relationships and provide the critical framework for raising the next generation are too important to be reduced to mere symbols in our most partisan and bitter political wars. Yet that is precisely what has happened. Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, are all responsible for politicizing the questions of family life, and thus contributing to the disastrous weakening of this most basic and important institution. Each of us across the political spectrum must now recognize the crisis of family life in America. The statistics are overwhelming and simply demand our attention. Nearly half of all marriages end in divorce. 1.5 million women a year are assaulted by their current or former husbands or boyfriends. One in three children are born outside marriage, even in poor communities, and so on. Family ties and relationships are growing weaker at an alarming pace, with disastrous consequences, especially for children. And the consequences are also clear for poverty, delinquency and crime, sexual promiscuity, education and employment, physical, emotional, and mental health, spiritual well-being, and social pathologies that transmit themselves intergenerationally. Family breakdown figures into a wide variety of other social problems as a primary causal factor. But as soon as the issues of family breakdown are raised as a public issue, A very ideological debate quickly ensues about the ideal forms of family life that various cultural, religious, or political constituencies wish to advance. What is soon lost are the facts of family life, and how those facts can be either weakened or strengthened. In the fall of 2003, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that gay and lesbian couples in that state are legally entitled to marry, thereby entitling them to the same legal, financial, and social benefits as heterosexual couples. That decision set off a great controversy that played a prominent role in the 2004 election debate. The city of San Francisco and other jurisdictions began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, and President Bush announced his support for a constitutional amendment to stop gay marriages, which were then performed by the thousands in both San Francisco and Massachusetts. The issue was joined. The topic now seems destined to continue as one of the most controversial issues in America for some time to come. Over the past decade, this family values question has become very difficult and has been polarized by both the religious right and the cultural left. To move forward, we must simply refuse the false choices offered by both sides. As we have already noted, the left has often misdiagnosed the roots of our present social crisis, mostly leaving out the critical dimension of family breakdown as a fundamental component of problems like poverty and violence. These issues are not important just to the religious right, and are not simply bourgeois concerns. We do need to rebuild strong and healthy two-parent families, and we desperately need more strong male and female role models in both nuclear and extended families. Today, family breakups, broken promises, marital infidelity, bad parenting, child abuse, male domination, violence against women, lack of living family wages, and the choice of material over family values are all combining to make the family norm in America more and more unhealthy. A critical mass of healthy families is absolutely essential to the well-being of any society. That should be clear to us by now, especially in neighborhoods where intact families have all but disappeared. But the right has seized upon this agenda and turned it into a mean-spirited crusade. To say gay and lesbian people are responsible for the breakdown of the heterosexual family is simply wrong. That breakdown is causing a great social crisis that affects us all, but it is hardly the fault of gays and lesbians. It has very little to do with them, and honestly, more to do with heterosexual dysfunction, and yes, sin. Gay civil and human rights must also be honored, respected, and defended for a society to be good and healthy. It is a question of both justice and compassion. To be both pro-family and pro-gay civil rights could open up some common ground that might take us forward. Do we really want to deny a gay person's right to be at their loved one's deathbed in a hospital with family restrictions? Do we also want to deny that person a voice in the medical treatment of his or her partner? And do we really want all the worldly possessions of a deceased gay person to revert to the family that rejected them 30 years ago, instead of going to their partner of the last 20 years? There are basic issues of fairness here that can be resolved with or without a paradigm shift in our basic definition of marriage. We can make sure that lifelong gay and lesbian partnerships are afforded legitimate legal protections in a pluralistic society, no matter what our views on the nature of marriage are. But the question of gay marriage is important. It is a major issue in the religious community, and it is unlikely to be resolved for many years. Many in the churches and the society believe that the long-standing and deeply rooted concept of marriage as being between a man and a woman should not be changed, but same-sex couples should be granted the rights of civil unions. That's still my own view. For others, only gay marriage fulfills the requirements of equal protection under the law. There are at least three different views being debated in the churches. Most Christians still believe that the sacrament and theology of the church on marriage should not be altered, while others are exploring new rites of church blessings for gay and lesbian couples committed to lifelong relationships. And still others want full sacramental inclusion. The states themselves will ultimately resolve the legal and civil issues through referendums and legislative proceedings. While the issues of gay civil rights are fundamental matters of justice in a democratic society, the legal and ecclesial questions of how to handle the specific marriage issue should not be used to divide the churches, as too many on both the religious right and religious left seem eager to do. I believe that the protection of gay civil rights should be a bottom line in the debate, and I try to say that especially in very conservative evangelical circles. On the issues of gay marriage, our Sojourners magazine has not taken a position, but rather an approach of civil dialogue between Christians who are committed to justice and compassion, but who have different understandings of how best to resolve the question of gay marriage. It is our view that while gay civil rights is a fundamental justice issue, the controversies over gay marriage and the ordination of gay bishops and so on should not be seen as faith breakers. The church is going to have to learn to stay together and talk about these things until we find some resolutions together. Many feel that legal protections can and should be extended to same-sex couples without necessarily changing our whole definition of marriage. But one could also argue that gay civil marriage is necessary under equal protection. One could also argue for church blessings of gay unions. I think all those are strong points, even if the churches are unlikely to change their whole theology and sacrament of marriage itself. But this is the good and necessary dialogue. And in the meantime, the church must stand up for gay and lesbian people under attack and must welcome them into the community of faith. Conservative Christians should be careful not to draw their primary line in defense of family at the expense of gay couples who want to make a lifelong commitment, instead of standing prophetically against the cultural, moral, and economic forces that are ripping families apart. And liberal Christians should not just argue for gay marriage on the grounds of human rights, but rather should probe more deeply into the theological, biblical, and sacramental issues that are also at stake. When conservatives seem to suggest that the future of Western civilization is at stake in the battle over the legal status of same-sex couples, they seriously overstate the issue. Likewise, when liberals say that resolving the legal issues surrounding gay unions is morally equivalent to the issues of racism, apartheid, and the Holocaust, they make the same mistake. Solutions to the definitional legal issues for gay couples will eventually be found, but this is not the ultimate moral confrontation of our time, as partisans on both sides have tried to make it. It will take many years before we are able to better understand and resolve the many complicated factors surrounding the issue of homosexuality. When we do, we should be able to look back and feel good about the way we conducted our dialogue and our relationships in the process. Ultimately, I suspect the legal definitions we use for gay and lesbian relationships will have less impact on our society than the definition of community that shapes our culture. Is the wildly successful Survivor television series just a game, or is it another sign that our culture is broken? I was on vacation doing some beach reading when the popular culture swooped down to drop another bomb. I was finally getting to read Tuesdays with Maury, the New York Times bestseller, about a very successful but unhappy sports writer who learns life's greatest lessons from his former college professor who was dying with Lou Gehrig's disease. On one of his weekly visits to see his old mentor, Mitch Albom asks Maury why so many people are living unhappy lives. Maury says, "Well, for one thing, the culture we have does not make people feel good about themselves. We're teaching the wrong things, and you have to be strong enough to say if the culture doesn't work, don't buy it. Create your own." No sooner had I read the sage's words when a copy of USA Today landed in my lap with a cover story, "Tonight, there'll be just one survivor." I have to admit I had missed all this, but I read that CBS was expecting upwards of 40 million people to watch the finale to the highest-rated summer series in television history, and advertising was selling for $600,000 for a 30-second slot. As most of America apparently knew, 16 contestants had been stranded on a desert island in the South China Sea for 39 days and had been successively voting one another off with the goal of getting down to a sole survivor, who would win $1 million. It had become what the media calls a cultural phenomenon. The newspaper cover story said, "The show's genius is its seeming replication of the underbelly of corporate America. The innocents who join Survivor as a lark, relishing the adventure, have been summarily dispatched by the schemers, conniving to shape the game's outcome by joining forces. Now, the 16 were down to 4 for the final episode, and the article concluded, each now knows the formula for success. Cunning and manipulation win out over likability, employed by all 4 remaining contestants." An expert on national trends added, "Pop culture dominates our society, and it's not to be taken lightly. So I just had to watch, since I had all this vacation time on my hands anyway. It was fascinating. The show opened with a very spiritual dilemma, the announcer saying, our goal was to work together to build a new world, but compete against each other to become the sole survivor and to win $1 million. It was to become the ultimate human experiment. I'll say, a series of alliances had worked well in getting rid of almost everybody else, but now it was all for ourselves," said one of the 4 remaining survivors. "What's it like sleeping next to your enemy?" said another. Wonderful human comments were now flowing freely. "I'm here for me, and everyone else can kiss my ass. I don't give a crap about anyone on this island." That was day 38. Sue, the truck driver, got voted out, and the last 3 put mud all over themselves, walked over hot coals, and then had to stand for hours with one hand on a totem pole of sorts, attached to an idol, one survivor insightfully remarked. Rudy, the former Navy SEAL, had a seeming lapse of concentration and let go of the pole, and soon they were down to 2, Kelly, the river rafting guide, and Rich, the corporate trainer who had earlier gained viewer fame by going naked on camera. Kelly was far superior to Rich in physical ability, discipline, and stamina, but it was Rich who walked away with the $1 million. Kelly was just too conflicted. "I've had a lot of moral issues," she said at a critical point. "There have been some moral low points, not so proud moments that don't belong in my life." Rich, as even Kelly pointed out, never pretended he wasn't scheming and conniving. He played the game from the beginning. "I respect that." And that's what Rich said over and over again in his final speech. It was all strategy. The ultimate winner acknowledged there were some sincere interactions and maybe starts of friendships, but it's about who played the game better. The sole survivor actually did poorly on a quiz asking what they all had learned about the lives and families of the other contestants. Instead, he was observing people's strategies and concluded, "I just want the million." The last 7 contestants who were ejected became the final jury to vote the winner. In the end, they concluded it wasn't the best or most deserving person up there, but merely the least objectionable. Did the end justify the means? It did on the island. The final 4 were praised for doing what they had to do, and Rich for doing it best. He got the alliance going, which proved so decisive in whittling the number down to the few. And in the end, he was the only one left standing. I guess the corporate trainer has been watching those fun-loving mergers, which have become such a game in the business world. Kelly admitted she had too many identities going on the island. Even Rich said his only regret was trusting people too much. One earlier contestant put it most bluntly, "I couldn't have been that ruthless. I can't even lie. My God, I'm glad I got out early. At least I can live with myself. That's the important thing." Yes, but she won't get the money and all those potential corporate contracts. By the end of the show, several survivors were already in the advertisements, drinking Bud Light or talking on cell phones on the beach. "It was a game that definitely parallels our regular lives," said the announcer. I wondered why nobody pointed out that all the white men on the jury voted for the white man. How's that for paralleling regular life? Perhaps the biggest adjustment my English wife has had to make in coming to America is the definition of community used in her new country. American culture is much more individualistic than her familiar British context. In everything from the role of government to the experience of her parish church to the solidarity of her old neighborhood, even across racial and class lines, the British are more communal than we are. They have a deeper sense of belonging to one another and a responsibility for one another. No British politician, for example, whether Labour or Tory, would challenge the basic nature of a healthcare system that regards medical care as a mutual social obligation rather than a commodity you may or may not be able to afford. The Anglican churches from which joy comes often look like the neighborhoods they are rooted in, rather than being commuter centers for like-minded homogeneous people who travel miles away from their homes to worship. America used to be more like that too, but becomes less and less communal every day. It is a harsh and cruel individualism that is now being forced upon us by our corporate, media, and political culture. And that is not good for family or community values. In fact, it destroys them. Yet, family and community values remain primary religious values, even if they are disappearing as American values. To reestablish that spiritual sense of community in our churches, our neighborhoods, and even in our national politics is a countercultural activity indeed, but one also in the best traditions of an older America that must now be urgently renewed. Happy New Year! Happy New Year! Happy New Year! That's what my 2-year-old son Luke said to everyone who entered the airplane on our return flight home after a New Year's retreat our family attended. I always enjoy watching expressionless faces turn into smiles when Luke starts talking to strangers. He must be the official greeter, one of the passengers remarked with a big grin. Luke just had a great time on New Year's Eve. Joy and I had hoped to use him as an excuse to go to bed early, but Luke danced until midnight at a big party with a live band that was just too much fun. Twirling, jumping, hopping, swinging, waving his arms, and even doing a little breakdancing on the floor, this boy didn't want the party to end. The countdown to midnight fascinated him. The kisses and hugs all around were a welcome surprise. And then everybody started yelling, "Happy New Year!" He thought that was so cool, he kept saying it to everybody for the next 3 days. And I loved watching the responses he got. Maybe it was the freshness and utter sincerity of the traditional greeting from the mouth of a little child with sparkling eyes that turned busy travel faces into broad smiles. And Luke would keep saying it until the person said it back. Or maybe it was because we really want to believe things can be new again at the start of another calendar year, even though our adult minds make us cynical about it. But isn't that the promise of Isaiah, John's revelation, and the whole biblical story? Our faith says that new beginnings are possible, always and in every circumstance. Yes, in the midst of our relationships, in the course of our work, in the health of our communities, and even in the history of our nations, change is always a real prospect. That's the promise of faith. And believing that is what makes the change possible. We are in the midst of great transition, in the politics of the country, perhaps in the dynamics of the economy, in the state of a world deeply mired in both poverty and conflict, in the battle against terrorism, in the struggle for justice, and in many of our personal lives. If we expect the worst, we'll probably get it. But if we can be as open to the new opportunities as we are to all the potential dangers, who knows what could happen? I enjoyed seeing people's responses to Luke's Happy New Year greeting. It literally lit up their faces, and maybe it reminded them of their hope for things really being new. A hope just beneath the surface for most of us too busy to stop and wish each other a Happy New Year. When I was growing up, it was continually repeated in my evangelical Christian world that the greatest battle and the biggest choice of our time was between belief and secularism. Everything was under attack from secular humanists, and believers had to defend whatever was sacred and significant from the onslaught. That kind of thinking led to the rise of the religious right, which I have challenged many times in this recording. But I have also been critical in these pages of what I call secular fundamentalism, among too many of our liberal elites who seem to have an allergy to spirituality and a disdain for anything religious. In particular, they have such a visceral reaction to the formulations of the religious right that they make the mistake, over and over again, of throwing all people of faith into the category of right-wing conservative religion. That mistaken practice has further polarized the debate over religion and public life in America, and has even deepened the impression among many Christians that the real battle is indeed between belief and secularism. But as I have argued in this recording, the answer to bad and even dangerous religion is not secularism, but better religion. And the best religion to counter the religious right is prophetic faith, the religion of the prophets, and, of course, Jesus. Prophetic faith does not see the primary battle as the struggle between belief and secularism. It understands that the real battle, the big struggle of our times, is the fundamental choice between cynicism and hope. The prophets always begin in judgment, in a social critique of the status quo, but they end in hope that these realities can and will be changed. The choice between cynicism and hope is ultimately a spiritual choice, one that has enormous political consequences. First, let's be fair to the cynics. Cynicism is the place of retreat for the smart, critical, dissenting, and formerly idealistic people who are now trying to protect themselves. They are not naive. They tend to see things as they are. They know what is wrong, and they are generally opposed to what they see. These are not the people who view the world through rose-colored glasses, the ones who tend to trust authority or who decide to live in denial. They know what is going on, and at one point, they might even have tried for a time to change it, but they didn't succeed. Things got worse, and they got weary. Their activism, and the commitments and hopes that implied, made them feel vulnerable, so they retreated to cynicism as the refuge from commitment. Cynicism does protect you in many ways. It protects you from seeming foolish to believe that things could and will change. It protects you from disappointment. It protects you from insecurity, because now you are free to pursue your own security instead of sacrificing it for a social engagement that won't work anyway. Ultimately, cynicism protects you from commitment. If things are not really going to change, why try so hard to make a difference? Why become and stay so involved? Why take the risks, make the sacrifices, open yourself to the vulnerabilities? And if you have middle-class economic security, as many cynics do, things don't have to change for you to remain secure. That is not intended to sound harsh, just realistic. Cynics are finally free just to look after themselves. Perhaps the only people who view the world realistically are the cynics and the saints. Everybody else may be living in some kind of denial about what is really going on and how things really are. And the only difference between the cynics and the saints is the presence, power, and possibility of hope. And that, indeed, is a spiritual and religious issue. More than just a moral issue, hope is a spiritual and even religious choice. Hope is not a feeling, it is a decision. And the decision for hope is based on what you believe at the deepest levels, what your most basic convictions are about the world and what the future holds, all based on your faith. You choose hope not as a naive wish, but as a choice, with your eyes wide open to the reality of the world, just like the cynics who have not made the decision for hope. The former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu used to famously say, "We are prisoners of hope." Such a statement might be taken as merely rhetorical or even eccentric if you hadn't seen Bishop Tutu stare down the notorious South African security police when they broke into the Cathedral of St. George's during his sermon at an ecumenical service. I was there and have preached about the dramatic story of his response more times than I can count. The incident taught me more about the power of hope than any other moment of my life. Desmond Tutu stopped preaching and just looked at the intruders as they lined the walls of his cathedral, wielding writing pads and tape recorders to record whatever he said, and thereby threatening him with consequences for any bold prophetic utterances. They had already arrested Tutu and other church leaders just a few weeks before, and kept them in jail for several days to make both a statement and a point. Religious leaders who take on leadership roles in the struggle against apartheid will be treated like any other opponents of the Pretoria regime. After meeting their eyes with his in a steely gaze, the church leader acknowledged their power. "You are powerful, very powerful," but reminded them that he served a higher power, greater than their political authority. But I serve a God who cannot be mocked. Then, in the most extraordinary challenge to political tyranny I have ever witnessed, Archbishop Desmond Tutu told the representatives of South African apartheid, "Since you have already lost, I invite you today to come and join the winning side." He said it with a smile on his face, an enticing warmth in his invitation, but with a clarity and a boldness that took everyone's breath away. The congregation's response was electric. The crowd was literally transformed by the bishop's challenge to power. From a cowering fear of the heavily armed security forces that surrounded the cathedral and greatly outnumbered the band of worshippers, we literally leaped to our feet, shouted the praises of God, and began dancing. What is it about dancing that enacts and embodies the spirit of hope? We danced out of the cathedral to meet the awaiting police and military forces of apartheid, who hardly expected a confrontation with dancing worshippers. Not knowing what else to do, they backed up to provide the space for the people of faith to dance for freedom in the streets of South Africa. Desmond Tutu is a believing Christian, and it was his Christian belief that kept him going during so many difficult times. I think it is significant that many leaders in the most oppressive circumstances find themselves going more deeply into their faith, becoming more personal about their relationship to God, and even more orthodox in their religious convictions. Martin Luther King Jr. tells the famous story about his kitchen table conversion in the middle of the night after his home had been firebombed. He tells of how his liberal and intellectual faith became much more real and concrete as he cried out to God in fear and distress. Ideas about religion would no longer be enough for King, as his life and that of his family sleeping in the next room were now at stake. God had to be personal now, and very real. I've simply seen too much not to believe, not to live and act in hope. In addition to seeing South Africa set free, here are just 10 more things I've seen and had the privilege to be a part of that give me great hope. As a teenager in the 1960s, I saw a civil rights movement led by the black churches suffer enormous violence but lead the nation to a history-changing Civil Rights Act in 1964 and a democracy-changing Voting Rights Act in 1965. I've seen former gang leaders on American inner-city streets literally standing between warring factions ready to attack with their hands up in the air shouting, "No, no, no, don't do this," and they didn't. I've seen campaigns of nonviolent direct action topple generals in Latin America, the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, and the bloody regime of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. I've seen people's movements bring down the communist governments of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, and I sat glued to my television set as gleeful Germans tore down the Berlin Wall brick by brick. I've seen North American religious people stand at the edge of Nicaraguan villages, holding prayer vigils within clear and easy rifle range of U.S.-backed Contra rebels in the nearby hills who suspended their attacks against local civilians because of the outside presence. And I saw the U.S. State Department blame the churches when the Reagan administration lost the final vote that cut off funding for the Contra War and decided not to invade the country because of a pledge of resistance that promised civil disobedience signed by almost 100,000, mostly people of faith. I've seen the religious community become the animating core of the 1980s movement to halt the nuclear arms race and help alert the nation to the nuclear danger. I've seen a prophetic minority but significant number of churches try to deal seriously with the proposition that racial reconciliation requires racial justice. I've seen churches and their leaders from across the theological and political spectrum come together on the issue of poverty and perhaps lay the foundations for a new movement of religious conscience for economic justice. I've seen courageous Christian lawyers and activists act to protect and rescue vulnerable women and children from the brutal and violent forces of the world's sex trafficking industry. I've seen wealthy Christian businessmen leave behind lucrative careers and dedicate themselves to lives of service to the poor, and even better, use their skills to help create sustainable economic development in the developing world. Now, at the beginning of a new century and millennium, I see a new generation of young Christian activists coming of age and committing themselves to seeking social justice, preserving the environment, acting for peace, and trying to live consistent lifestyles, often in ways that require significant sacrifice and risk-taking. I often had the opportunity to participate in gatherings of church leaders that bring evangelicals and Pentecostals together with Catholics, Orthodox, and mainline Protestants. Quietly emerging in the United States is the kind of broad interdenominational and cross-confessional table that America has rarely seen, now called Christians Coming Together, CCT. One clear consensus among the church leaders is on the centrality of the issue of poverty. During one of the initial proceedings, one of the nation's most prominent Pentecostal leaders asked me if I thought evangelical and Pentecostal Christians were developing a deeper social conscience. I could tell that he thought so and hoped that I did too. When I told him I absolutely agreed that leaders from his tradition, especially the younger generation, were undergoing a real social transformation on issues of compassion and justice, a big smile broke out across his face. The conventional wisdom still says that liberal Christians have a social conscience and evangelicals do not, preferring instead to focus only on the personal morality of issues such as abortion and homosexuality. The media, in particular, keep that perception alive. But the big story that most of the press, including the religious press, continues to miss is how much that reality is changing. On at least three key social issues, poverty, race, and the environment, evangelicals are exhibiting a growing conviction and conscience. In local congregations, poor neighborhoods, and legislative halls, a new evangelical activism and advocacy is emerging. Sometimes the greatest stories of hope are the ones closest to home. It's often been my own best friends who have offered the hope that helps keep me going. Bill Bright was the founder and president of Campus Crusade for Christ, an evangelical student organization on campuses around the country. A conservative businessman from Southern California, Bill became the ultimate evangelist, motivated, above all else, by the Great Commission. He wanted to reach every person on the planet for Christ in this generation, but his special burden and passion was to reach young people. He was also known to be very conservative politically and, on virtually every single issue, usually found himself in agreement with the right wing of the Republican Party. Concerned about the moral degeneration of America, he wanted America to come back to God, which for him meant an ultra-conservative political agenda. Bill and I were both evangelical Christians, but clearly disagreed on a whole range of political issues. In 1976, he got involved in a project to get conservative Christians organized politically, with John Conlon, a far-right congressman from Arizona who had presidential ambitions, and a whole range of conservative Christian groups, a plan was formulated to mobilize evangelical prayer and cell groups for political purposes. It was, in fact, the first attempt to create a religious right in American politics. Several years before the eventual founding of successful groups like the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition. Several people who had gotten wind of this new evangelical political initiative contacted us at Sojourners and suggested we do an investigative story on the plan. We decided to investigate and found a very ambitious political effort underway. It became the most extensive investigative project we had ever undertaken, and the story took several months to complete. In April 1976, it became a major cover story for Sojourners called The Plan to Save America. The story got picked up across the nation and in several local newspapers, including in Arizona. The more people heard about the effort to politicize Christian prayer and fellowship groups, the more many didn't like it. There was a clandestine feel to the political organizing effort that also turned many off when it was finally exposed. A few years later, much more overt political initiatives to create the religious right that we know today would prove far more successful than this awkward first attempt. But Bill Bright was publicly embarrassed by our story and the whole experience. He blamed us for that, and me in particular. Though we had been scrupulously careful to back up every fact in the story with at least three sources, Bright angrily denounced me. We invited him or the others involved to respond, both before and after the article was published, but but they never chose to. Because we also differed on almost every political issue, from Vietnam and foreign policy to economic and domestic issues, a bitter and public polarization grew up between Bill Bright and me. The bad blood continued for many years. I remember a particularly painful moment at a dinner for evangelical leaders the night before the annual presidential prayer breakfast in Washington, D.C. one year. In the personal introduction time, Bright again went on the attack with me in a very public way, calling me a liar. A shouting match erupted between Bright and my defenders, and I feared a fist fight would break out. We didn't see each other for many years, and the bitterness seemed to subside over time. More than two decades had passed when Bill Bright and I found ourselves at yet another leaders' dinner the night before another presidential prayer breakfast. People were milling around before the meal, and I saw him across the room. I swallowed hard and headed in his direction. He turned to shake another friend's hand and obviously didn't recognize me after so long. We had both gotten a bit older. I introduced myself, and he became quiet. I said, "Bill, I need to apologize to you. I was in a hotel several months ago and knew you were also there. I should have come to your room, knocked on your door, and tried to mend the painful breach between us after all these years. I didn't do that, and I should have. I'm sorry." The now old man named Bill Bright melted into my arms and rested his head on my shoulder. Then he said, "Oh, Jim, we need to come together. It's been so long, and the Lord would have us come together." We both had tears in our eyes and embraced for a long time. Then Bill said, "Jim, I'm so worried about the poor, about what's going to happen to them. You're bringing us together on that, and I want to support you." I was amazed and humbled. We agreed to get together soon to spend more time. A few months later, Bill and I were again, coincidentally, at the same hotel, a wonderful place in Daytona Beach, Florida called El Carib, where an extraordinary Christian laywoman named Marianne Richardson had turned a business into a ministry, serving both local and national Christian groups across the country. She has been a good friend to both Bill and me for many years. I called Bill and told him I was on the floor below. We agreed to a walk on the beach together the next morning. It was a wonderful stroll along Daytona Beach. We shared our own conversion stories, which we had never done before, our callings and dreams for our respective ministries, and how we might be more connected. Bill Bright, the conservative businessman from Southern California, then astounded me. He said, "You know, Jim, I'm kind of a Great Commission guy." I smiled and nodded my head. "And I've discovered that caring for the poor is part of the Great Commission, because Jesus instructed us to teach the nations to observe all the things I have commanded you. And Jim, Jesus certainly taught us to care for the poor, didn't he? Caring for the poor is part of the Great Commission," said Bill Bright. When we got back to El Carib, Bill asked if we could pray together. We sat down and grasped each other's hands, first praying for each other. We also prayed for each other's ministries. Bill Bright prayed for me and for the work of Call to Renewal and Sojourners. When we were finished, he said he wanted to raise some money for our work of the Lord. In the months that followed, Bill began to get sick. He was now over 80 years old. I kept track of how he was doing. Then one day I got a letter from Bill Bright. Here's what it said. "My dear Jim, congratulations on your great ministry for our Lord. I rejoice with you. An unexpected gift designated to my personal use makes possible this modest contribution to your magazine. I wish I had the means to add at least 3 more zeros to the enclosed check. Warm affection in Christ. Yours for helping to fulfill the Great Commission each year until our Lord returns. Bill." Inside the letter was a check for $1,000. As I was reading Bill's letter, my colleague Dwayne Shank walked into my office. "Did you hear?" he asked. "Bill Bright just died." We looked at the postmark on the letter and compared it to the news reports of Bill's death. We concluded that writing me this letter was one of the last things that Bill Bright did on earth. Bill sent a $1,000 gift to the magazine that had exposed his most embarrassing moment more than 30 years before as an affirmation of the ministry of another Christian leader whom he once regarded as his enemy. I couldn't hold back the tears. And I can't again as I write down this story for the first time. The experience of my relationship with Bill Bright has taught me much about the promise and power of reconciliation. I will never deny the prospect of coming together with those I disagree with, ever again. It is, indeed, the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ to break down the walls between us. Thank you, Bill. I will never forget you. Our world, and the United States in particular, is becoming increasingly pluralistic religiously. How do we navigate the new waters of religious diversity in America and beyond? I remember a prayer vigil that Call to Renewal held in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol when 50 Christian leaders came to protest legislation we found very detrimental to poor families and children. The night before the action, I got a call from Rabbi Michael Lerner, who asked, "Can you use a Jewish rabbi?" "Sure," I replied. "You can read the Isaiah text." The scene the next morning was dramatic indeed. Dressed in clerical garb, pastors and priests, lay leaders and seminary professors, religious sisters and organizational heads, and one rabbi stood in a circle to pray and read from the scriptures. "Woe to you legislators," read the words of Isaiah, "who write oppressive statutes to turn aside the needy from justice and to rob the poor of my people of their right." The sergeant-at-arms of the National Capitol Police offered our call to worship when he proclaimed over his bullhorn, "You are not allowed to pray in the rotunda of the United States Capitol." That was all we needed, and we settled in to pray. One by one, we were handcuffed and led away by the police. Rushed off to jail, we began many tedious hours of processing and waiting until they finally let us go, pending trial dates, in the middle of the night. But we had almost 12 hours in jail together with no phones, conference calls, meetings, deadlines, or to-do lists. For most of us, the break in the routine was glorious, as was the fellowship with our brothers and sisters. When do people like us get to spend so much time with one another? I smiled as I looked around the massive jail cell and focused on what seemed to be a very vigorous conversation going on between Baptist preacher Tony Campolo and Jewish rabbi Michael Lerner. I moved closer to hear. They were discussing Christology, the theological topic concerning the nature and identity of Jesus Christ. Who was Jesus is still perhaps the most provocative religious question in our interfaith world. Tony and Michael were deeply engaged together. Was Jesus the very Word of God made flesh, or a great Jewish prophet? They clearly didn't agree, and were not likely to convince each other anytime soon. But the amazing dialogue taught me something very important. Perhaps the best place to discuss theology is in jail, after you have all been arrested for acting on your faith. Act faithfully, then talk about why you have faith and what your faith means. Michael always tells me he wants Christians to be the best Christians they can be, and then find ways to cooperate together with Jews around the biblical vision of justice. I don't believe in interfaith services and activities where everybody is afraid to say anything that someone in the congregation might not agree with. Don't change or water down who or what you are for your interfaith brothers and sisters. Don't be afraid to express your faith clearly and compellingly. Act on your faith, then reflect together. And the best place for our theological seminars might well be in jail. Hope isn't always just about ending apartheid, ending global poverty, and other matters of life and death. In the midst of tax cuts for the rich and no child tax credits for the poor, weapons of mass destruction missing in Iraq, eroding civil liberties, and Code Orange as a way of life, sometimes it's good to talk about something uplifting. Basketball. One thing I've learned after many years of social activism is that you have to learn to enjoy the world while you're busy trying to change it. And some consistent sources of enjoyment are necessary for a balanced and, yes, hopeful life. For those of you who don't follow basketball, the San Antonio Spurs defeated the New Jersey Nets on Father's Day 2003 to win the National Basketball Association championship. The Spurs are a team full of nice guys, in stark contrast to the thug and flash role models who have come to dominate the NBA in recent years. Who says nice guys finish last? It was the final game in the remarkable career of David Robinson, the 14-year veteran San Antonio center, and what a way to go out. Robinson had been a league most valuable player, won defensive player of the year, made the All-Star team 14 times, and was named among the best 50 NBA players of all time. But most important, David Robinson is known as one of the best people ever to play the game. Motivated by a strong Christian commitment, Robinson spent $9 million to start a school for inner-city kids and didn't even name it after himself. He and his wife Valerie run a faith-based foundation that addresses the physical and spiritual needs of families. And he created Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, a section of special seats reserved at all Spurs home games for needy kids and their parents. In the final game and throughout the playoff series, the 38-year-old Robinson made a mighty contribution to winning his second NBA title. He scored key points, snatched critical rebounds, blocked shots, and raced down the court on his old legs to make a dramatic steal that turned pivotal Game 4 around. After the sweet victory, the scene on the court of an emotional David Robinson holding his three sons with his own father at his side on Father's Day was a rare and welcome picture of family values in big-time sports. The most valuable player in the championship series and the season MVP was Tim Duncan, Robinson's companion at power forward. Duncan was utterly dominant during the entire series, with his consistent spectacular play and team leadership, yet at the same time, he evidenced a humble spirit almost never seen in professional sports today. A humble NBA basketball star, Duncan is a quiet, even self-effacing, just-get-the-job-done kind of guy. But get it done, he does. In the last game, Duncan accomplished the nearly unbelievable, a quadruple-double, meaning he reached double figures in four categories: points, rebounds, assists, and blocked shots. Game announcer and Hall of Fame center Bill Walton just kept repeating that Duncan was simply the best player in basketball today. Take that, Shaq, Kobe, and Iverson. Duncan doesn't trash talk, chest bump, strut his stuff, go into tirades for the camera, or embarrass his city off court. Instead, he just plays good, smart, team-oriented, and amazing basketball, and brings a big breath of fresh air for all of us who love the game, but have gotten depressed by players with no work ethic, no respect, no character, and lots of commercial endorsements. The whole San Antonio team seems to embody the ethos of Robinson and Duncan, showing that good habits and attitudes can be as infectious as bad ones. While, of course, staying focused on Iraq, the federal budget, and faith-based initiatives that bring a prophetic political witness, I watched every game of the championship series. It proved to be a welcome break and lovely diversion from life's intensity these days. It brought together two great things: good basketball and good values. What a combination. Culture does shape politics, and spiritual values are central to that. Role models, in particular, are hugely important today, especially in shaping the character of young people. Perhaps the best thing the Spurs did that year was to beat the mighty Los Angeles Hollywood hype Lakers, who have gotten used to cruising through the season and winning the playoffs. But in 2003, the post-game interviews were not with oversized prima donnas droning on endlessly about themselves, but with polite and modest superstars giving the credit to their teammates, a great game, and even to God. Sweet. Epilogue. We are the ones we've been waiting for. One of the best street organizers I ever met was Lisa Sullivan. Lisa was a young African-American woman who earned the trust of urban youth in Washington, D.C., and around the country. Lisa was from D.C., a smart kid from a working-class family who went to Yale and earned a Ph.D. With early jobs in major national foundations and nonprofit organizations, Lisa felt called back to the streets and the forgotten children of color who had won her heart. With unusual intelligence and entrepreneurial skills, she was in the process of creating a new network and infrastructure of support for the best youth organizing projects up and down the East Coast. But at the age of 40, Lisa died suddenly of a rare heart ailment. At her graveside, Marion Wright Edelman and I held each other and wept for the loss of one of the most promising leaders of her generation, a friend to us both. Lisa had worked with Marion's Children's Defense Fund and was on the board of Sojourners. Lisa's legacy is continuing through countless young people whom she inspired, challenged, and mentored. But there is one thing she often said to them and to all of us that has stayed with me since Lisa died. When people would complain, as they often do, that we don't have any leaders today, or would ask where the Martin Luther Kings are now, Lisa would get angry. "We are the ones we have been waiting for," she would declare. Lisa was a person of faith, and hers was a powerful call to leadership and responsibility and a deep affirmation of hope. Lisa's words are the commission I want to use to conclude this book. It's a calling the prophets knew and a lesson learned by every person of faith and conscience who has been used to build movements of spiritual and social change. It's a calling that is quite consistent with the virtue of humility, because it is not about taking ourselves too seriously, but rather about taking the commission seriously. It's a commission that can only be fulfilled by very human beings, but people who, because of faith and hope, believe that the world can be changed. And it is that very belief that changes the world. And if not us, who will believe? After all, we are the ones we have been waiting for.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.